Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Hey, it's Todd. Before we get started, if you like what you hear or you have any questions about this podcast, please tweet at me at @Todd_Garner on Twitter. Look forward to hearing from you.
For nearly 30 years, Todd Garner has overseen blockbuster films like Con Air, Anger Management, Triple X, 13 Going on 30, and Black Hawk Down.
Why are they letting you make these movies?
Join Todd as he shares tips and stories from the front lines of producing in Hollywood.
I'm Adam Sandler.
I'm Rebel Wilson.
This is Jeff Probst.
I'm Kaylee Cuoco.
I'm Eli Roth.
This is Marlon Wayans.
Hey, it's Ed Helms.
This is Shay Mitchell.
Everybody, this is Kevin James, and this is The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
What a combination.
All right, I'm here with Stephanie Elaine. Hello, Stephanie.
Hello, Todd. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Stephanie is one of the most prolific producers working today. She started her executive career at Columbia Pictures, where she championed such films as Boys in the Hood, El Mariachi, Poetic Justice, and Higher Learning. In 2003, she founded Homegrown Pictures, where she's produced such films as Hustle and Flow, Something New, Dear White People, and The Weeknd, just to name a few. And she is, among other things, a member of the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences, where she produced the 92nd Academy Awards, which is the most inclusive Oscar telecast in history, and sits on the board. Yes, and sits on the board of Women in Film and the PGA, and on and on and on and on and on.
Yes.
How are you? Where are you right now geographically?
I am in my home office in Studio City, California.
And did you have any productions shut down during the pandemic, or have you started anything in this COVID world?
Well, yeah, actually, Dear White People, fourth and final season, was delayed. It was supposed to go up in the spring, but we're shooting now.
Wow.
So that's good. And over the course of the quarantine, I have produced a couple, all virtually, which has been nice to keep busy and productive and also safe.
How did you do that?
So it's all because of necessity. You know, like with Women in Film, every year we produce the Crystal Lucy Awards, and you can't do that. So instead of gathering at the Beverly Hilton in the ballroom, we decided we were going to, for the first time, create a show that was virtual. And so we licensed the show to the CW. And I produced, along with Monica Levinson and Amy Baer, an hour-long show called Make It Work, which is all about the resilience of women during these incredibly challenging times. And it was also a fundraiser for women in the business who are out of work and who need help. So we raised about $300,000 and, you know, got a lot of people, including Jane Fonda and Rita Moreno and Ava Longoria, and the list kind of goes on and on, Alfred Woodard, just a lot of industry women. It was a variety show. So we did music, we had Sheryl Crow, we had Secretary Clinton. It was a combination of music, sort of Saturday Night Live skits, like skits, and testimonials about amazing women. And the premise was hire her back, because during a pandemic, during a recession, of course, women are the first to get fired, the last to get rehired. And when we do, at a significantly less amount of money than we were making before. So the idea was to call attention to women who are amazing at their jobs and who should be hired back.
Wow. And you did it all virtually. Everybody was virtual from their homes.
Everybody was virtual. Wow. We sent COVID cleaned cameras and mics and setups. And we used Evercast, where we could watch the performances and we could edit on that. It was super fun, actually.
Wow.
And then for the last 8 weeks, I've been involved with the Zoom Where It Happens, which is a recreation of or reimagination of classic sitcoms by Black actresses. And then we added the guys in, too. So it started with Golden Girls. We did Golden Girls. We did Friends. We did Sanford and Son 227. And we ended the series with A Different World, which Debbie Allen directed an episode she directed 30 years ago. So, and the point of that was literally to lure people in for the entertainment and then give them all kinds of information about voting, about the census, engage people to get fired up to vote.
That's incredible. And where is Dear White People filming?
Well, we always do in Sun Valley and various places around L.A. Mm-hmm.
Wow. And how has it been? Have you been on set?
I have not been on set. I literally, you know, we do all of our table reads virtually on Zoom.
Wow.
Zoom stock has gone through the roof, by the way. read scripts and watch dailies. And I can do all of that virtually. So yeah. No need.
That's incredible. I just got back from Atlanta, having shot there for 8 weeks.
And, wow.
Yeah, it was a fascinating exercise in people's ability to do the right thing when called upon.
Were you in a studio?
We were on location and on stage and all in and around Atlanta, and everybody on our crew performed to perfection and did the right thing. And we didn't have one single positive.
Wow.
So, yeah, it was very, very, very lucky, but also a testament to when people are called upon to do good work, they'll do it. They'll do it. And they'll be good people. So before we get to your incredible producing career and executive career, let's go back to New Orleans where you were born.
Okay.
And then you quickly moved to Los Angeles, and you, neither of your parents are in the business. So where did you start this love of film and wanting to do this?
Well, I've always been an avid reader. And I think the first connection I really made between the page and the stage, so to speak, was with two novels. One was The Godfather and the other was The Exorcist. And
how old were you when you read those?
I mean, probably 10 or 11, something like that.
You know what's so interesting? The Exorcist is probably responsible for more people getting in the business than anything else.
Interesting.
So many people I talked to had parents that did the inappropriate thing and let them watch The Exorcist or Jaws, or let them read The Exorcist or Jaws. And it just completely freaked them out to the point where they thought, I need to do this. I need to freak people out the way I'm freaked out right now.
Well, I read both those novels and then snuck in to the theater. Not snuck in, but I would wait outside until an adult would buy me a ticket. My parents definitely did not let me go. But I lived around the corner from the El Rey on Wilshire Boulevard when it was a theater. And I would just hang outside until I saw some nice person and say, hey, can you buy me a ticket? And was just fascinated with the relationship between what I had read and what I was watching. And at that point, yeah, I didn't know anybody in the business. I had no idea what a director did or a producer or an executive, none at all. But I did love movies and I did love reading. And so I went to USC, pre-law, because of course, why not? And by my sophomore year, was so unhappy, I dropped out and I moved to Hawaii.
Wow.
And that was sort of the big turning point in my life, because I fell in love with an artist and a dancer. And I realized that you could actually have a life in the arts. My father's a biochemist. My mother's an educator. You know, like most Black parents, they really sort of instilled the importance of education and a professional career of my choice. But I came back from that thinking, I can't do it. I really have to find a way to be an artist. And because I loved reading, I've always written. I was like in fifth grade being excused from class to go write because I was a writer. And so I decided I was going to leave leave USC, and I'd researched all these different places, and UC Santa Cruz had an amazing writing program. And so that's what I did. After doing a semester in Madrid and just, I don't know what else I was doing, but anyway, ended up It's Santa Cruz for my junior year. And those last 2 years really shaped me in very significant ways. I met and fell in love with my first husband. I met all my friends. I became a dancer and a writer and a poet and, you know, graduated in creative writing and just reveled in the beauty of being an artist. And then I graduated and I'd been taught by an incredible dancer named Donald Byrd, who basically was leaving UC to go to CalArts. And so I auditioned for CalArts and I went to CalArts as a dancer, because even after all of that, my literature, the creative writing, all of my professors really thought I should get a master's in literature, but I got hooked on dance. And so I followed him to CalArts and danced for a year until I started getting postcards from people who had graduated, and they were in New York, and they're like, "We made it! We made it! We're working! We're making $200 a week." And I'm, "Uh-oh, check, please. That's so not going to work for me."
Had you not seen Chorus Line at this point?
You know, I had, and I loved Chorus Line, but you know, I don't know. I didn't realize, and these people were much better dancers than I was, so I was like, "Uh-oh, I better think of something else at this point." And then I got pregnant and I'd left CalArts. I moved to San Francisco. I was living in San Francisco. I was working at the ballet magazine, San Francisco Ballet Magazine, as a writer. And my boyfriend from college, who was in the business. Now, he was the only person I knew. He wanted to be a director, but he was working as a location manager or something. And actually on Desert Hearts, they were shooting in Reno, Nevada. And I went to see him for a weekend, and a couple months later, I was like, "Holy crap, I'm going to have a baby." I had no job. I had no place to live. I moved back into my old bedroom where I'd read The Godfather, and tried to figure out what I was going to do with my life. And at the time, my boyfriend, who was a couple years younger than me, was totally freaked out. You know, I was 23, he was like 21. And I realized that I could do one thing really well, and that was read, something I really loved to do. And I found out there was a job called reader. I was like, bingo, that's for me. That's what I'm gonna do. So I asked somebody who knew anybody who was hiring as a reader, and they directed me to an agency called H.N. Swanson. And H.N. Swanson was an agency that represented Hemingway and Fitzgerald and Faulkner and all these classic writers who I, you know, fell in love with. So I showed up there like 6 months pregnant. I said, "I want to be a reader." And there was an old trunk of material that nobody had read that hadn't been covered. So the agent there, and I can't remember his name, I wish I could, said, "Sure, I'll teach you how to be a reader for free." So I said, "Wow, great, sounds good." So I read for a few months these novels, these manuscripts, and created coverage. You know, it was the first time I'd learned how to write coverage. And then I heard about a job at CAA. I knew somebody who said, "Hey, there's a story department at CAA. They hire readers." So I basically had my son, Wade, and I showed up, and Bob Bookman basically hired me after I called him every other week for 3 months. And put me as a reader of books in the story department under John Carles. Wow. And that's where that was my first industry job, you know, my paid industry job. And so I worked at CAA it was 3 days a week, 2 days at home, 3 days in the office. It was $1,100 a month, I think, something crazy like that. And I learned to read and to write coverage. And I graduated from books to scripts, which was what everybody wanted to do because they were shorter, quicker. And I met all the folks at CAA because I was actually a really freaking good reader. And I wrote amazing coverage. And so pretty soon, you know, Fred Spector, just people were calling going, I want you to read this. I want you to read that. And I had my son, which was an awesome thing to do while you were reading, breastfeeding and being at home for a couple of days. My mother has been so helpful in just being my nanny for my kids while I have worked. And then I heard about another job, which was Story Analyst. And Story Analyst was the same thing, only for a studio and making like $50,000 a year. I was like, holy crap, I've hit the jackpot. So you have to take a test. I took the test, the roster was low, and I got hired at Fox. And now I was like, I have arrived. I'm on a lot, a studio lot. This is amazing. Scott Rudin was running the company then. He was the head of production. And there was a young exec, Amy Pascal, and she had just been promoted to VP there. And I read something for her. And she called me up and she said, I love you. That's, I want you to be my reader.
A good Amy impression.
I said, okay. So Amy literally brought me into the room where she was meeting with writers and agents, I mean, actors and directors. And I sat in the corner and I took notes and then I'd come back with my notes, you know, from the sessions. And I remember Scott used to call me Cyrano de Bergerac because I would sit in the room, but I would do all the writing. And that was amazing, you know. And then I heard you could go from that to being an executive. But before that happened, Amy left to go work for Don Steele when Columbia was sharing a lot with Warner Brothers in Burbank. And they didn't have an opening for me there, but they did have an opening at Warner Brothers. So I took a job as a reader at Warner Brothers, and every time you jumped a job, you would get like an exponentially higher salary. So I was going $75,000. I was like, whew, this is amazing. and I was there for I think a month. It was 1988, and there was a writer's strike. And I was the last hired, first fired. And I lost my job after leaving Fox and moving to Warner Brothers. I lost my job the next month. And I remember I called Amy and I was like, holy crap, like I lost my job. And she goes, come meet with Don. And so I got all dressed up and I went to meet with Dawn, and she was so scary. And she was in her big office barking at Marty Scorsese on the phone, and she hired me. And so I got a job, and Amy said, if you work for me for a year as a reader, I will promote you to creative exec. So I said, okay. So I worked for almost a year, I think. And then I had to, you know, forego my $75,000 a year and go back to $50,000 a year to be a CE. And then I was literally in the big house. Then I was in the studio system. And then she called us golden retrievers. You know, we had to find the script, find the project. And literally the first thing that I did was try to replace myself in the story department, because of course there were no Black people in the story department. And I met a kid at USC named John Singleton.
Yeah.
And he came in for ostensibly an interview to take a reader job, but all he could talk about was this script he'd written called Boys in the Hood. And I just curious, and you know, John, he's such a showman. Sure. He was like, but you can't read it. And I was like, what do you mean? He goes, I'm going to do it with John Hughes. And I was like, John Hughes, that seems weird, but okay. I badgered
him. Because he was at CAA, right? And so was John.
Exactly. So,
well, before we get into the John Singleton, sorry,
because
there's so much to unpack what you just said.
Okay.
So, and I don't want to jump the gun because I want to revel in that story. And by the way, at this moment, I am at in Columbia Plaza East with you. So, but on different wings. But let me go back. Two things. One, you were 23 years old when you decided you wanted to be a reader, correct?
I was probably by then, 24, something like that. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's so insane because that's exactly how old John Singleton was and Robert Rodriguez was when you guys met. Mm-hmm. It's a weird age, 23, because I remember John being 23 and then you found Robert Rodriguez and you championed him. He was also 23. So there's something so interesting about that age where you guys, all three of you, kind of decided this is going to be life changing and we're going to do this different thing. And then second thing was just your calling relentlessly. That's a thing that's always been about you, is just your tenacity. Where, like you said, you just kept calling Bob Bookman relentlessly. You did the same thing with this agent at CAA because you didn't want John to do it with John Hughes. You called relentlessly, and you did the same thing with Robert Newman and Robert Rodriguez. And so that's, and I think so many people think when they just from the outside, and this is a huge reason why I love talking to people like you and do this podcast, is because I think people on the outside think, oh, well, Stephanie Elaine, look at her. She's a fucking all-star. And, you know, and she was working with Don Steele and Amy Pascal. It's like the Super Bowl. And she's so smart and so put together. She probably just walked in and got the job. And then she met John Singleton and Robert Rodriguez. You worked your ass off and you did. And even though you were in CalArts, which is like the epicenter for artists and creative people, you still went to San Francisco and still didn't know exactly what you do. It takes a lot of It takes a lot of moves. It takes a time when you're ready to do that job. And also, it's fucking hard and you have to make the calls. And even you have to, even though ostensibly John Singleton drops into your lap, you had to work your ass off to get that movie even submitted to you. And then even harder to get it made. So I just wanted to stop there because I think that, you know, I know you do a lot of teaching at Peter Stark, and you also have the LA Film Festival, and you're very active with young people, encouraging them, especially people diverse and women. And so I just really wanted to talk about your struggle of, like, just, you know, you didn't just get the CAA job and you didn't just get to make Boys in the Hood. You really worked your ass off to do that.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, Todd, I've never gotten anything without that type of drive and persistence. And it really comes from passion. You know, I mean, I couldn't have pursued any of those things unless I was obsessed with them, unless I was consumed by it. When I read Boys in the Hood, I went to school in Inglewood, you know, high school in Inglewood. I knew kids who were like this. And I just saw it so clearly. Like, it wasn't a calculated thing. It wasn't a piece of business. It was, I have to get this made because I intrinsically understand it. I believe it's important. And I just can't stop until I'm done. Like that, that's where it really comes from. And the same thing when I saw El Mariachi. I remember I was, I eventually married my boyfriend a couple years. My son was, I think, 3. And we were at home and Robert Newman had sent me this tape, a VHS. I feel so old. A VHS.
Well, that's all he had. That's all Robert had, because he had a 3/4 inch master.
That's right. I popped it in and over dinner and, you know, I know a little Spanish. So this thing was all in Spanish. And I was just amazed at how well the story was being told visually, you know. And I just thought, this kid is talented, you know. That's the main thing. I just kept thinking, wow, like if he did this, and you know, of course, the legendary story. It was $7,000. He sold his blood, this and that. So I just went back to work and said, I got to get on a plane and go down to Texas and meet this kid. So all of those things, nothing happens easily, you know, at least for me in Hollywood. It's always been, I have to get this done by any means necessary.
So let's go back. So you're ostensibly going to replace yourself as a reader, and John bullshitted his way into the studio by saying he wanted to be a reader and then instantly started pitching you
exactly
Boys in the Hood.
Exactly.
Let's walk through that in that entire process. So you hear this pitch. Was there a comp? Was there something where you were like, this is like Hamlet for you know, people of color? I mean, was there some comp where you went,
you know, comp
I have
was?
To make this movie?
You know what the comp was? The comp was, believe it or not, Stand By Me, which my husband had worked on as a location manager.
Right.
And I'd been around that. And just these kids, being around the kids, because, you know, it was River. It was all these cute little kids. And they were on a journey to see a dead body. I forgot what exactly it was. To see a dead body, I think is what it was.
Yes, to see a dead body.
But it ostensibly was a coming of age story. Really,
yes.
It was a story about choosing your path in life. And then, of course, this was just all black, you know, which I hadn't seen. And I loved John, you know, I just loved him. Like, we just looked in each other's eyes and just saw each other. That's what it felt like, you know. And so I just said, this is it. Like, it was literally, if I was sitting with Oprah, I'd say, this is my aha moment. I was like, this is why I'm here. I can get this movie made. I know these people. I know this movie. This is what I can do. This is why I'm here. It was just sort of like this big light bulb that went off. And I also knew that it wouldn't be easy, because at the time we had just been sold from Coca-Cola to Sony. Don literally was fired. John and Peter came in. It was such a roller coaster. John and Peter came in. They bought the lot, the Thalberg, you know, the Culver City lot. Everybody was moving. We weren't making anything. I mean, the studio had completely shut down. And I knew that I had time. So instead of, and those weekend read tables were brutal. Oh my God. Dawn was such an animal in those rooms. I mean, she would tear you apart. I remember it was Gareth. Like, I felt like she made Gareth Wigan cry one time. You know what I mean? Like, it was just hardcore. And in fact, one time, and you know how those meetings are.
Oh, sure. Wait. So was Dawn the first, who was the first person you told there's this movie called Boys in the Hood to?
Probably Amy.
And she was an EVP at the time. So I remember right, it was Dawn, Amy, Darris Hatch, Gareth Wigan, and then from the
Michael Nathanson,
Teddy Z, and then from the Price
and Rob. Well, also,
and Price Entertainment merges in, and you have Jordan Bear and Matt Leipzig.
Jordan, Matt, yeah. And then also, but it was also
Bob Jaffe
Stacey
and
Snyder.
John Dashney and Stacey
Snyder. Yeah, but it was
Snyder.
Also Stacey Snyder and Michael Bessman, because it was also that whole, now, that table was huge. Huge, I remember. But the crazy thing was that, you know, you get a piece of paper, there's 12 scripts on it, and behind the scripts, there's, you know, initials of who's supposed to read it, right? And I remember one of my first or second meetings, Dawn turned to me and she said, well, what did you think? And I said, well, I didn't read it. My name's not on there. She launched into me. Like, I was like, well, hold up. You can't talk to me that way. Like, I didn't know I couldn't do that. You know what I mean? I was just like, hold on 1 minute. I was not supposed, like, I just went right back at her, you know? And she leaned back with this little curl of her mouth and said, okay, then. Like, it was a real lesson, you know? Like, I was like, yeah, I'm not going to be talked to like that in this room full of all these people. No way. When I'm not in the wrong. But guess what? After that, I read everything.
Oh, yeah.
I read everything. And even when I wasn't called on, I would volunteer just to let people know I had read everything. Like, that was what you call the black tax. That's when you have to be better than everybody else, you know?
Yeah.
So I didn't put it on Weekend Read because there was too much shifting. There was too many new people. It was too big of a room. I'd thrown something else on there, like, you know, a week or two before, and just got creamed. And so I was like, I'm not doing that. I'm going to take the script to everybody individually. I came up with this thought that I'm going to bring it to them. I'm going to say, look, it's really important to me. I know these kids. I went to school in Inglewood. Can you read this for me and just talk to me? And so I did that with every single executive. And by the time we moved over to the new digs, that was the first week I put it. And by this time, Frank Price was now, you know, in charge of those meetings. Don was gone. John and Peter were doing whatever John and Peter do. And we had reassembled in the Thalberg conference room. And that was the first time I put it on the weekend read. And by the way, everybody had told me, I think it's really well written. I think it's really great. Yes, I'll support you. Because, you know, it's a political room. You have to gather support for your projects.
And what a political time. It was so friggin' chaotic at that point because everybody's, I mean, John and Peter only put Price in there to bury his deal, get rid of Don because John didn't like Don, and they bring Price Entertainment over, and then they started getting picked off one by one. Those execs started leaving, and all the while he's got his eye on Canton, who's stuck at a deal in Warner Brothers. So I mean, it's just madness. It wasn't like it was just like, okay, what great movie should we make? It was like, we're rebuilding this lot. We got paid $200 million to take this studio over. We want to make this the biggest studio ever to justify this giant price that Sony has just paid. Oh, and by the way, all of Price Entertainment thinks they are going to get the job. I remember when, because I worked for Jordan Bear. So I was right next to Julia Dre, and I was right across from Bob Jaffe. And rest in peace, both our dear friends. Yeah. And so I was like right at the T of the Thalberg building. So I could see, I was like, Darius, goodbye, and Amy, goodbye, all of it. It was just madness. It was like, and I remember we all were picking at our offices and Wendy Margolis, who was president of Price Entertainment, her assistant, where all the assistants were cruising around, oh, this will be your office, and I'll get this office set up for my boss, and I'll be in this cubicle. And there was no office for Wendy Margolis, and that's how she found out she got fired. I mean, it was batshit crazy. It was so crazy.
Remember all the flowers? Like, felt like every day we'd have new flowers at our desk.
And so nuts, which is even more incredible that you got this little movie, niche movie made. It obviously blows up and changes cinema as we know it. So at that weekend read, does everybody go around and stand up, or did people like look at their shoes and be like, oh boy, here we go?
Yeah, everybody fucked me. I'll be honest with you. It was insane.
It's totally normal.
I know, but I had no idea. I thought that I had this all worked out. Like, I had spoken to everybody individually. They all pledged allegiance to the script. And then we got there, and, you know, Frank was such a wily guy. Like, he would just say, all right, let's look at this Boys in the Hood. Let's go around the room, you know? And so we start going around the table, and one by one, I just realize I've been completely screwed, you know? And except for Amy, who was like, I think it's really good, you know? But she was my girl, you know? So I was like, oh, fuck. And then we got around the horn back to Frank, and Frank said, well, I think it's terrific, and I think we should do it. And then I went, holy crap, Adina, this is how it goes, you know?
Nice.
And it was great. It was one of those, and I've had a few of those moments, you know, of abject failure turns to abject success.
And vice versa.
And vice versa, yeah, exactly. But of course, I only remember the other ones.
I have to. It's the only way you can get up. You have to do it today.
Yeah. So
wow, that's incredible.
It was great.
This is going to be fun. What was the green light process like? What were the comps? How did they green light that movie? How did they pick a budget?
You know what? It was pretty amazing because I remember we were making a couple movies then. We were making Last Action Hero, which was $100 million whatever. Like, that script was so bad.
To be fair to Last Action Hero, at that time, John and Peter wanted a franchise. They were coming up. They walked away from Batman. They thought they needed it. They needed a big blockbuster. It perfectly fit into Mark Canton's skill set in terms of what he was great at, which is managing talent and big movies. Barry Josephson was on the rise. He loved those kind of movies. I've had him on the podcast.
He's all a dear. True. He's all friend. True. But and the so, script sucked.
Well,
I'm just saying, like,
If
that was the measure of success, there'd be very few movies that would get made in Hollywood.
And the fact is, this little movie, Boys in the Hood, was going to be like a pimple on their back. Like, they didn't even care. They were like, fine, Frank wants to make this movie. It's $5 million, whatever. I was still a CE. They had to promote me to VP just to supervise the thing. And I remember I was in a big, because I was hired at the same time as Jashny and Bob Jaffe, right? And Bob Jaffe is the scion to, you know, Stanley. And Jashny is like a mogul in the making, right? And I remember they had started to renegotiate both their deals to be like directors or something. And they hadn't come to me. And I talked to my lawyer. I was like, I don't understand. She was like, well, you know, this is how it is. Like, you know, whatever. And then I found Boys in the Hood. And then all of a sudden I catapulted above them to VP. It was really funny. And then, I didn't know anything. I never made a movie. I'd never been on a movie set. The green light process was to find a producer. That was our first big hurdle, just to find a producer. Russell Simmons wanted to do it really badly. I remember George and Doug were, you know, thought of because they had just done New Jack City. But I'd had a friend, Steve Nicolaitis, and Steve had produced, he'd been working with my husband for the last few years, produced Stand By Me and A Few Good Men. And so I said, well, what about Steve? Because Russell wanted to bring John to New York and have him direct music videos and said he's not ready, he's too green, he needs to direct some music videos, whatever. And Frank just instinctively thought that was a bad idea. And then I brought up Steve, and Steve had just made A Few Good Men for Columbia. It was a big hit. I introduced them, and John just fell in love with Steve, and Steve with John. And so we got a producer. And literally, this was happening so quickly because I believe the move was in the summer, sometime like in June or May or something like that when we moved. And by August, we were, you know, prepping the movie. And we shot it, I think, September and a little bit of October.
The casting process of that was...
Yeah, that's where I was about to go.
Oh, sorry, sorry.
He knew that he wanted Ice Cube and he knew he wanted Fishburne. Those were the two done deals. We got Jackie Brown to cast. And, you know, that was when this is to this day, always the most exciting part when you see the script come to life through casting, you know? And so they set up a little office in Leimert Park and we started getting these tapes of these young kids, you know, Nia Long and Ice Cube and Morris. And you could just, the words coming out of their mouths was just electric. I still have those tapes, by the way. It was electric.
Amazing.
And Cuba. And so I started showing those to Frank and he was like, this is fabulous. This is fantastic. So then, yeah.
Also a good Frank Price impression, by the way. You might have a second career here, Stephanie.
So basically, we were in production before I even could blink, you know, and shooting in South Central. And, you know, Gary Martin was the head of production. And, we just shot it. It was pretty quick. I think it was like 6 weeks, something like that.
So this is a big thing. And I know you have this new company. We're going to get into Hustle and Flow because you continue to do it. You continue to find these filmmakers and support them. But why isn't there another Robert Rodriguez, another John Singleton that's getting noticed as much and as famously as those two guys? I put Brewer in that same thing, but why? What's happened? Is it just that it's too easy to make content and people are doing other things? But it just feels like where are those 23-year-olds with those visions right now?
Well, there are. I mean, for instance, you know, Ryan Coogler. I mean, he came straight out of film school at USC, and then blew right up. You know, there's Gerard McMurray, who by the way, Ryan turned me on to, And I produced his first movie, Burning Sands, for Netflix. And then he went on to do The Purge and a bunch of other, which was the biggest Purge, the Black Purge, biggest Purge movie. Okay. There's Sana Hamri, whose first movie I produced, you know, Something New, who blew up in TV and became, you know, incredibly successful with Empire. There's tons of young.
How are you finding them?
I mean, basically, after John and Robert, you know, I sort of was pegged as the kingmaker for you know, young filmmakers of color. And so I had a lot of incoming. When my heart starts beating fast, that's when I know I have to, if I'm watching something or if I'm reading something, then I feel compelled to throw down the gauntlet and, you know, get that filmmaker across the finish line.
Does that for you? What can somebody do that's right now listening to this? That's like, you know, because I'm so embarrassed to even admit this, but I finally read Rebel Without a Crew over the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And I was just felt like throwing this book at every young person that comes to me and says, how do I get in the movie business? Mm-hmm. I just feel like, read this fucking book and find, mm-hmm. find some, especially now, that poor guy. I started off as an editor, and I can remember doing the things he was doing with 3/4-inch tape to make, you know, mm-hmm. to put all the sound on one track so he could mix his music on the other track and trying to sync things up. You don't have to do that anymore. Now you can make a movie. I mean, these phones are way better than the cameras, the 1-inch cameras we had back in the day.
Sure.
And you can edit on your Mac. So I feel like just throwing that book at everybody going, here, do it. But what is your advice? Because you speak at Peter Stark, and you have this LA Film Festival, and you're very big on education, which I want to talk to you about, because I read a really good article that you wrote. I want to talk to you about also. But what is your advice to these young filmmakers? How do they get Stephanie Lane's attention? How do they make her heartbeat fast?
Well, they have to do the work. You know what I mean? Like, they have to do the work. They have to either write something that is so compelling, or make something that's so compelling. That's what it is, and that's what it takes. It's not like I'm shaping these kids. I'm just finding them and shining some light on them, you know. And what happened was, I did spend a decade doing that after and Craig, of course, Craig Brewer is another. Whose script I read and just had that moment of, oh my God, this is worthy, you know, this is worthy. It took us a long time to get that movie made. You know, I paid Craig's rent. I flew him out for meetings. I just really believed in that story, because it's the story of how art elevates you, no matter who you are. And but the script was great. You know, the script was great. So to me, I think what you were saying is absolutely true, which is there's no excuse now. You know, there's so many programs. There's Final Draft. There's your phone, which you can edit on your computer. You can edit on your frickin' phone if you wanted to, you know. So there's no excuse. If you want to be a filmmaker, you have to be a filmmaker. If you want to be a writer, you have to write. And you have to rewrite. And you have to... you know, really make that film as beautiful and as fresh and as uniquely you as possible. That's really what I respond to. I don't really go in for, you know, big action or genre things. I go in for personal stories. Mm-hmm. That's what turns me on personally. So, but then I decided, you know what? I can't do this anymore. Like, Dear White People. Okay, I made that movie for $15,000. That's like how much I got paid to make Dear White People, you know?
Right.
And it just became, well, wait a minute. I'm launching all these youngsters who are going off to do all these great big things. And I'm finding the next one and the next one. But I'm not building any wealth. I just got to a point where I couldn't spend the time that it takes. Like, you know, Hustle and Flow took 4 years to get made. So basically that's when, because I have been involved in so many organizations to promote equality, equity, diversity, and inclusion, I had been on the board of Film Independent when Rebecca Yeldham had to step down from directing the LA Film Festival, and I just raised my hand, not knowing anything about directing festivals except for being a filmmaker at them, and realized that I could actually shine a spotlight on a lot of filmmakers at once by identifying films that I loved, by hiring a really diverse staff of programmers to find films, to put the spotlight on women and filmmakers of color and LGBTQ. And so I did that for 5 years, which is amazing. During the time that I ran the festival, it was profitable, which festivals, you know, traditionally it's really hard to be profitable. That's why they're all nonprofits. And we sold like 30 films that the year that I had the inspiration to make the festival about LA filmmakers and to fulfill the mission statement of Film Independent, which is to, you know, create a more inclusive Hollywood. And so that year, and it also coincided with the Netflix and Amazon and all the streamers, you know, looking to acquire films before they were actually turning themselves into studios. So it was a great confluence of events that created that. And that was great. But at the same time, I was like, I'm getting the itch. You know, Gina Prince called me and said, will you produce, you know, my movie Beyond the Lights and, you know, and Justin's movie. And so I got lured back into producing. And also, since I had been, you know, I had thought of myself as a writer for so many years, and I'd spent so many years working with other writers and helping other writers, I was like, you know what? When I turned 50, I said, I'm a fucking writer. Why aren't I writing? And right. So I had been writing this whole time, but I was like, I would call myself a closet writer. You know, I wouldn't show, I was writing these scripts, I wouldn't show anybody. And then that year, I basically got into the Writers Guild, got hired by New Line to adapt Misty Copeland's book about her becoming a ballerina. And, you know, it's just, I really like pushing myself. I really like scaring myself. I really like stepping out on a limb and seeing what happens if I fall. And if I fall, like, you know, how to get back up.
That's great advice for everybody, by the way.
Yeah, it's fun, you know. It's exciting. I'm addicted to having my heart beat fast, I guess. I like that. I like that feeling. And win or lose, you learn, you know. So then I said, okay, I'm back to producing, but now I have to up my game. So in the last few years, I told myself, I can't do these small movies anymore. I have to get back into the studio system. I have to make movies that actually have fees that, you know, I can live off of. I married a man who is a big songwriter, producer, Broadway writer, and really got sucked into the world of theater, and which really helped me with the Oscars, by the way, but just being in the moment of live theater and the prep that goes into that. You know, he wrote music and lyrics for The Color Purple, and he's working on some other big shows right now. And it's been a real journey. Both my kids have turned into filmmakers. You know, my oldest son, Wade, is an actor and a writer and a producer and a director. And my youngest son is an amazing editor and also a fantastic writer. I also produced their first movie, which they co-directed, French Dirty, which we own and licensed to Netflix. It's on Netflix right now. So my next slate, I'm so excited about, because I have big movies that are uniquely, you know, diverse and inclusive. I have my Shirley Chisholm movie, which I'm putting together. I have Rapper's Delight, which is the story of Sylvia Robinson, the first Black woman, first person to think of recording a rap record. you know, and I'm in business with just so many talented writers and directors and actors. And I started my TV business, which has been very exciting. So I've got shows at HBO and, you know, my deals at Warner Brothers. And I'm really excited about the next, you know, 5 years coming up, just pumping out a lot of awesome shows and films.
That's great. So that is a perfect segue into, since you did produce the most inclusive Oscars in history, and you are, as you say, pumping out great content for the next 5 years, where do you see the business headed in terms of diversity and inclusion? I know that there's been a lot of titles ascribed to it, like officers and people watching out for it and watch groups. And there's been some twittering about it and some deadline articles about it. But what can we do as a whole? Because there's, you know, a lot of people in the business listen to this, and I would imagine, because it's you, a lot of people are going to be tuning in to hear your opinion about this. What can we do for the next 5 years? Because that's all generally people can get their heads around, to do better. I read an article that you wrote about, just that fascinated me, about, you know, just your white friends calling to check in on you, but you saying to them, you know what I'd rather you do is call your schools and make sure that your kids are being educated on civics and Black history. And I actually did that. And so
that's
obviously deeper than just making Hollywood better.
Sure.
But obviously everything that's going on in our country right now.
Oh, God. Oh, my God. I can't have it. I've just been, you know, I mean, I did sleep last night just because I'd probably been up for the two previous nights.
We should say that this is being done on the day after the election. That would be a whole other hour.
Yeah.
But just let's talk about what you think and what you would say to all of the, especially white executives and agents and people that listen to this podcast and assistants that listen to this podcast, What can we do to make it better for the next 5 years? Because it's obviously profitable, even though that's the other thing that's so shitty, is that you were making these little movies that you weren't getting huge fees on that are in terms of their margins are massive. So it's bullshit that they're not profitable. And obviously Netflix has a whole business based on diversity and inclusion in terms of their audience. Mm-hmm. What can we do to make it better for the next 5 years?
Well, I mean, I think that you can hire, I think everybody who's in a position of power can hire Black creatives across the board. That's gatekeepers, that's executives, that's agents, that's critics. It's writers, it's directors, it's, you know, I think in the past it's been sort of acceptable for white artists to tell Black stories. And I think that if you want to get closer to an authentic, you know, experience, then go to the source. So I think it, and I, you know, like when you're in the business as long as we've been, I think it's like the stock market. Like it goes up, it goes down, but over the course of history, it goes up, you know, and I see that. I believe that to be true. When you see things like Lovecraft on HBO, you know, you recognize they're spending a lot of money on that show. And that is, you know, Black queer female creative who's behind that, you know. So I think it's really about putting money in the hands of a diverse group of talented artists to tell their stories, because we know that there's so many studies. We know that, you know, the more reflective of society the content is, the more folks are going to want to see it. Notwithstanding living in this country right now where white supremacy is, you know, at an all-time high, I will just say that, you know, hire Black creatives, hire Latinx creatives, hire LGBT creatives, you know, and let let the plenitude of those stories, you know, saturate the marketplace. Because not only will you make money, but you will change hearts and minds. You know, I learned that on my very first movie on Boys in the Hood, that that you could humanize people through representation.
Yeah.
And that is really the be all end all for me.
Right.
John taught me that, the specificity that he brought to his story, the humanity shines through. And I think that, you know, that's why back in the cave days, we told stories, you know, just to comfort ourselves, to teach ourselves, and to love ourselves.
Yeah, I think I'm going to badly butcher this quote, but I think John said at one point, the more specific you'll find, the more everybody can relate to it.
Yes, the more specific, the more universal.
And that's
that
what it
is
was,
also
yes.
a tenet of poetry, which I learned in school, which is the more specific it is, the more universal it becomes. And I think that is definitely true.
Yeah. So what is getting you excited? I know you're excited about the next 5 years and the stuff you see coming up, but just in terms of, to try to end this on a positive note, what, like, you going back to that young Stephanie Elaine, seeing these filmmakers come in, and obviously there's so much coming your way. What's getting you excited to do the next phase of your career?
What's getting me excited is my granddaughter, Kiana.
Oh, that's amazing. That's amazing.
You know, she was born on Earth Day during the pandemic, and
she's
like the light of our lives. And just knowing that, like, life does go on, you know,
like
there is hope, there is love, there's music, there's fun, you know, even in this pandemic, we've been able to celebrate and live our best lives, you know, and we know this will pass, you know, it's not going to be around forever. It's going to pass. This political moment in time will pass. We're so blessed. We're so uniquely positioned in content business to continue to expand the boundaries of love and of acceptance, you know, through our stories. And so for me, it's, you know, I just want to be able to be healthy enough to keep doing what I'm doing and to shine a spotlight on others who are doing great. And I know that eventually, just like the stock market, it's gonna keep going up.
Right. And it is very, very comforting to know that something like Lovecraft can get made, even during all the shit that's going on, that authenticity and specificity and passion will find a way.
Exactly. Exactly. And Dear White People was so ahead of its time. You know what I mean? And Justin was so ahead of his time. And so I just know that there's so many new voices out there. And with the tools that we have, more people can make content with less money. And that's also a great equalizer. That's the other huge thing that's happened over, you know, the last 15 years. It's just the digital revolution has democratized the craft, you know?
Yes.
And so if you can go out and, like, my good friend, Steven Soderbergh, he's not my good friend, but he is my friend. You know, just make, like, look at the movies he makes on his phone. They're incredible. You know what I mean? And so I think we all should aspire to just pick up our phones and make some great, great stuff. That's what I'll say. Like, let's
great
just
advice.
all be creative, because creativity is the light at the end of the tunnel, and it's the light while you're in the tunnel too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I always ask this at the end, and it can be any one of your movies. Best day on set.
Oh God, best day on set. Jesus Christ, there's just so many. I mean,
you can have more than one.
I mean, okay, I just really memorable day on set. It was a hard day. It was hustle and flow. And we were shooting the scene. It was nighttime. We were shooting the scene where DJ kicks out one of his girls and even kicks out the baby and puts the baby outside. And I remember Craig's mother was on set that day. And John had flown in the stunt double for Halle Berry for Catwoman because he had this vision that DJ was going to literally like kick this woman down the stairs. It was Paula, the actress. And we were going to replace Paula with the stunt woman from Catwoman. And I said, oh, no. We are not having our hero, as low down dirty a dog as he is, kick this woman, literally have her roll down the stairs. It's just not happening. And John was like, oh, yes, it is. Yes, it is. It's going to happen just like that. This is hardcore. This is for real. This is how the shit goes. And I said, no, John, we're not doing that. Because if you do that, no one will root for this guy to win. And that's what the movie is. We can't do it. And we literally had to stop production. We had to stop production. Craig didn't know what to do. He was caught between mom and dad. He didn't know how to solve it. And so Solomon did, which is, somebody said, well, maybe Craig's mother should make the decision.
Whoa.
The first time she was on set. And they just presented the whole thing. I presented my case. John presented his case. And she just said, oh, we're going with Stephanie for sure. So
that's
if
amazing.
You see the movie. And John was so mad at me. He's like, it's like in the Jetsons when they put the dog out, or the Flintstones, or one of those things. It was like, he just plops the dog out. And I said, yep. That's what we're doing, and that's what we did. So,
meanwhile, the poor stunt woman standing there going, wow.
The poor stunt woman had flown
in. Caused this kind of problem.
Exactly. She never got to work that day, but that's okay. She was witnessing history, so.
Well, thank you, Stephanie, so much.
Thank you, Todd.
You have mentioned so many times in this podcast as being such an inspiration and such a light, and you are both of those things. So yeah, I really, really appreciate you.
I'm very excited for you. I love this series, and I think it's so wonderful that you're shining light on producers who are literally the ones who usually shine the light. So thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of The Producer's Guide. We're produced by Kirsten Woodward and Steve Delamater. I want to answer all your questions about the business, so make sure to tweet me at Todd_Garner or use #Producer's Guide on Twitter. See you next week.